We welcome in the founder and president of the Children's Defense Fund this hour, Marion Wright Edelman. We will talk with her about her new book, The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small, Charting a Course for the Next Generation. The book is a call to action for all Americans to address the urgent needs of the country's youth. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 past 8 on this Thursday, December the 11th. And we will welcome your questions for Marion Wright Edelman at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Marion Wright Edelman is the author of The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small, Charting a Course for the Next Generation. She joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You published this book on the anniversary of the Children's Defense Fund?
Well, on the anniversary, our 35th anniversary, I would have liked to have been out of business by now. Mm-hmm. Because we would have done the right things for children, but it is also the 40th anniversary of the Poor People's Campaign, which is the origin, the parent organization of the Children's Defense Fund. And I wanted to report to Dr. King on the progress we had made and still have to make if we're going to create a level playing field for every child in America.
That's right. You were involved with with that campaign and with Dr. King, who unfortunately was assassinated before your march.
Right, but his messages are still as relevant today as then.
Yeah, so what's your report for Dr. King?
Well, he warned us about the dangers of excessive materialism or poverty, of militarism and of racism, because he warned that they could destroy us, and that if America did not use her wealth to include every person in its largesse, then he was afraid that this would lead to our destruction. Well, I think we can report that we've made very, very significant progress. He would be ecstatic about and so proud of America with the election of Barack Obama as our president-elect and 44th president of the United States. He would be so pleased with the growth of the middle class among black and Hispanics and many others. He would be so pleased about the tripling of our GDP since he died calling for a Poor People's Campaign in 1968. But he would not be pleased when he sees that when he died, there were 11 million poor children. Today, there are over 13 million poor children. That is a number that's going to get far worse, and that the gap between the rich and the poor is at its widest pace ever. He would not be pleased that the growing cradle-to-prison pipeline, which I highlight in this book in a chapter to our leaders on America's sixth child, who is our poor child, a majority of them live in working families, but who don't have hope and opportunity in our society. And he would be very upset to learn that a black boy has a 1 in 3 chance of going to prison in his lifetime, and a Hispanic boy a 1 in 6 chance of going to prison in his lifetime, and that we are seeing our children come out of school uneducated. A majority of all of our children, of all races and incomes, are not able to read at grade level in 4th, 8th, and 12th grade, and over 80%. Of our black and Hispanic children. If you cannot read in this globalizing society, you're being sentenced to social and economic death. And I think that he would be calling for a Poor People's Campaign today, as we see 13 million children in poverty, many more Americans in poverty, and this economic debacle, I think, is a reflection of the kind of rampant greed and excessive materialism that he warned us against. And so I think that, and he would not be pleased to know that we're engaged in two wars rather than one. When he left with the Vietnam War, he understood that that was stealing from the life chances of poor people here in America as well as in that poor country. So he would be calling for us to end this militarism. So I think it's a very mixed bag, but I think that we know with this new revival of the American dream that we can begin to move ahead, but we must address the very fundamental issues of justice for our people here and around the world, and we must invest in our human capital, and investing in all of our children is going to be the key to whether America is going to remain strong in the future.
Yeah. How hopeful are you that that President Obama and his administration will address these issues?
Well, I think that he understands the importance of investing in children and in human capital. He's got so much in his plate. with two wars to solve, with this extraordinary and unprecedented economic downturn, with global warming and our energy crisis. So it's a lot. But whether or not he is able to address this depends on what we do as citizens. And so in addition to writing a letter to our leaders, I wrote a very strong letter to our citizens and to all of us, because how great or successful he is going to be able to be in turning the moral compass of our country around depends on us and the movement that we build from the outside. And we must provide that voice. I tell a story very often about a visit of A. Philip Randolph to the White House to visit President Franklin Roosevelt. And he was reporting on the incredibly difficult conditions of the black community and the need for jobs and education and an end to discrimination. And President Roosevelt listened to him with great sympathy, but at the end of that conversation he said to him, "Phil, I agree with everything you said. Now you go out and make me do it." And in a democracy, you know, it's the voice of people that move people. And we have got to make sure that in the middle of all these extraordinary crises, that our children's needs to have health care, every one of them next year, and we're going to be debating universal health care for everyone, and I hope we get it. But if we don't get everyone at once, when the CHIP bill comes up, the State Children's Health Insurance Bill, which has to be reauthorized in 2009, I hope we will let our voices be heard with all of our senators and congresspeople, that all children, not one-third, the CHIP bill that was passed to try to please a President Bush who was not sympathetic to providing health care for more children, even though we have 9 million uninsured children, and that number is going to dramatically grow with the loss of jobs and housing and with the downturn in the economy, but we must insist that we do better than that bill that was passed by the Congress and vetoed by President Bush. It left 6 million children out. God did not make two classes of children. Every child is of equal value. And so I hope that the first thing all of us citizens will do is to tell our president-elect and our senators and our congressmen, we want a CHIP bill that can cover all 9 million children and pregnant women to stop this low birth weight problem that we have in America, that we want to give comprehensive benefits for every child and equal benefits to every child between the CHIP program and the Medicaid program, that we want to make it simple and stop this bureaucratic hurdle, all these bureaucratic hurdles that keep so many children from getting health care for which they are eligible. And we'd like to end the lottery of geography, because I think a child's life in Wisconsin is of equal value to a child's life in Mississippi or Louisiana or Maine or Vermont. And right now we have a 50-state lottery, and many states are cutting back on their CHIP benefits. And you can actually have two children in the same family, one of one age eligible for the Medicaid Children's Program, which has comprehensive guaranteed benefits, and another that's eligible for CHIP, and the child on Medicaid can get mental health and dental health and comprehensive benefits, and regardless of the economic downturn, those benefits are guaranteed. The child on CHIP may get nothing or get far fewer. That's not right. And so this is our chance to move forward, to show that we've got a new era of change here, and to do sound policy so all children, all have comprehensive equal benefits, all are able to get it in a simple way automatically at birth and when they are in any other means-tested program or start preschool. And I would like to see a federal income floor of 300%, which is about $63,000, that every child will be guaranteed that, regardless of where they live, with the right of people to buy above, to buy into that if their incomes exceed 300% of poverty. So but we could do that in January or in February and March. And so I hope that we'll make our voices heard. And the second thing is that we obviously have to have, we've got to have an economic stimulus package to try to get our economy working again. And I just want to make sure that as we talk about the middle class, that the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit and improving food stamps and increasing participation and improving child care and lifting the eligibility lines for working people, that the poor will not get lost. We know what to do to try to get money into the hands of people at the bottom as well as in the middle. And I just hope that the poor will be helped in this very, very hard time.
Yeah.
But they must be helped.
Yeah. Our guest is Marion Wright Edelman. She is the founder and president of the Children's Defense Fund, and she is also the author of many books. Her very latest is The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small, Charting a Course for the Next Generation, which is a call to action to all Americans to address what she calls the urgent needs of America's youth. We welcome your questions for her at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up later today, it's At Issue with Ben Marins after 5 this afternoon. If you're looking for a good book to give for the holidays, or you're looking for your own great read on a cold, snowy winter's night, you can join Ben and his guest after 5 o'clock as they talk about books to enjoy over the holidays. That's coming up after 5 o'clock this afternoon. Here's a book you might enjoy. The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small, Charting a Course for the Next Generation. It's written by my guest this hour, Marion Wright Edelman. She is the founder and president of the Children's Defense Fund, looking to chart this course for the next generation, calling on all Americans to try to end poverty and child poverty in the U.S. And we'll talk some about what you can do. And we welcome your questions, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Marion Wright Edelman, one thing that listeners can do is on your website right now, you're saying, tell President-elect Obama that health coverage for all children is important to you. So there's a hint.
That's a big hint. And I think that the operative word is all, because at the time when we have 9 million children, it's so cost-effective to get them into preventive care and to intervene early and to keep them out of costly emergency rooms, to immunize them, which saves, you know, many, many, many dollars on the back end. And so this is an economic stimulus. If you get all the children in the house and really expand our child health system as a first phase into universal health care, it will do much to stimulate the economy and enable children to be healthy and enable them to learn in school. So many children are sitting up in classes unable to see or hear the teacher or understand the teacher and have attention deficit disorders, which have not been diagnosed. And we have thousands of children sitting up in juvenile justice institutions solely because their parents could not get mental health services from them in the community. That's the most expensive thing we could do. And so this is good justice for children, but it is also good economic policy, and I hope that the president will act on it quickly.
Yeah, apparently the president's transition website is asking the question, what worries you most about the health care system in our country? And so he's asking for Americans' input, and you're urging people to make sure that the universal health care and health care for children are not ignored in this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the justice system and the issues you brought up a little bit earlier, because Wisconsin has a very, very sad distinction of having one of the worst numbers in the country in terms of the discrepancy between blacks and whites in our prisons, and in terms of disproportionately more blacks are in prison in Wisconsin, more so than any other state in the nation. What needs to be done about this?
Well, I think that Wisconsin is not alone. The racial disparities are overwhelming, and a lot of this is driven by poverty and racial disparities, which start with children at the beginning. You know, a third of all black men, 20 to 29 years old, are now in prison. They need to be fathering at home, and this is a catastrophe in the black community and for the Hispanic community, where the numbers are also very, very high. Because once you get into prison, and let me just say that a majority of those who are in prison are there for nonviolent offenses. And because of the unequal sentencing policies between crack and cocaine, you will find, although there is equal drug use among blacks and whites, that blacks are three times more likely to be convicted and sent off to prison for these drug crimes than others. And that zero tolerance policy is one that we're going to have to reexamine. But it's a disaster, because people who were in prison for felonies are unable often to get jobs, and prison becomes a revolving door. They are often politically disenfranchised in some of our states, and what a costly operation this is. We are the world's leading jail in the world, and our states are spending on average three times more per prisoner than for public school pupil. I can't think of a dumber investment policy. We have a $200 billion prison industry in this country. They employ more people than our three largest industries, including GM and Walmart. This is not sensible, and we really have got to change the paradigm from punishment as a first resort to prevention and early intervention. Frederick Douglass, the abolitionist, strongly said to us a long time ago wisely that it's so much easier to build healthy children than to repair broken adults, and that's why this cradle-to-prison pipeline is so serious. And if we give children a level playing field from the beginning with health care and with early childhood investment, with schools that teach them how to read, and one of the things that is worrying me very much is that our schools have adopted in many ways the zero-tolerance drug policies and carried them over now into zero-tolerance discipline policies, but you know, without clear distinctions between nonviolent offenses or others. And so you see 7-year-olds and 8-year-olds actually being expelled or being arrested on school grounds for behaviors that used to be handled in the community. And this is already pushing children off on the trajectory toward criminal justice systems rather than toward college. And we must begin to break this cycle of punishment that is bred at the intersection of poverty and racism. And so it's a real call to wake up, see what is happening, and to reinvest our money in people when it can make the most difference and be the most cost effective. But Wisconsin, as I get older, you know, I don't really want to be supporting millions of people in prison. I want them to be supporting a strong Social Security and Medicare system for all of us. And so this is a national problem that must be addressed, but we must change our investment policies and invest in education rather than in prison.
Well, speaking of education, the Bush administration, I understand, actually took a motto or theme of the Children's Defense Fund and turned it into No Child Left Behind legislation. How's that working?
Well, it's a very, very mixed bag. They took our legal trademark, which is Leave No Child Behind, and we believe in our mission. And they put it on as window dressing. We asked them to not do that. We did not agree with many of their policies. They used it as a way of appearing to be doing things that they were not doing. And so we'd like our mission back. And we have not given up on it. But I think that the No Child Left Behind Act, which many people confuse with real legislation that we had for comprehensive investment for children, needs a very thorough debate this coming year as it is reauthorized. We need to be focusing far less on high-stakes testing, even though it's very good that we're trying to bring in new accountability standards, and to really focus on teacher quality, teacher training, entice more people into this profession, value that profession more, but hold them accountable. And we need to be investing in early childhood to make sure that every child is ready for school, and to, at the same time that we're trying to hold schools accountable. And I write a letter in my book to teachers and to educators to talk about high expectations for all children and our belief and respect for children being so crucial. And I cite the wonderful positive example of what's going on in Wake County, North Carolina, which is Raleigh, which is one of the few whole school systems that has lifted the floor because they really do have clear goals and high expectations for all children. And I think that we just must begin to hold schools more accountable, but not in rigid ways. And the important thing is, again, quality and good teaching and high expectations for all of our young people. But I think that we need to have a robust debate, but not again. We need to get out of silos in our thinking. Schools must do their job, and I say in this book that if you don't love children, even if you have the smallest classroom and the most money in the world, get out of teaching, because the key thing is, you know, children see through us all as adults. But we must hold our schools accountable, but at the same time, we must make sure that children have safe havens after school. They're in school only 17% of their time. Parents must begin to foster an ethic of achievement in their homes. And I write a letter to parents, tell them to cut off those TV sets, turn off that computer, and really begin to focus on reading and interaction and expectations for our children and discipline rituals so that children know that they must be achieving. And I write a letter to neighbors and, more importantly, to the faith communities, because we should be trying to make sure that their doors are open and that children have a place to go after school and in the summer months. And at the Children's Defense Fund, we have worked very hard to develop an integrated reading curriculum in something we call Freedom Schools. We now have 138 of them, which are run by college students, many of them in churches or in community institutions, to teach children a love of reading and to teach them that they can make a difference and to make learning fun. And children respond up or down to our expectations. And I'm so pleased that in our first national evaluation of 19 Freedom Schools in Kansas City, supported by the Kauffman Foundation, that our children are actually doing significantly better in their reading because they really have gotten engaged with books. But we must, in our homes, in our churches and mosques, and in our schools, just really have high expectations, clear goals, and support children in and out of school. But poverty also makes a difference, and so we must work in our families, in our communities, but really hold our schools accountable for doing a much, much better job.
Our guest is Marion Wright Edelman. She is the founder and president of the Children's Defense Fund. We're talking with her about the urgent needs of America's children. Her latest book is The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small, Charting a Course for the Next Generation. We welcome your thoughts and questions for her on the needs of the next generation, and how do we end poverty and the problems that it poses to children and America. 1-800-642-1234, toll free from anywhere, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. To the phones in a moment, Marion Wright Edelman, but I did want to get your reaction to, on the campaign trail, President-elect Barack Obama did address the thought of personal responsibility, and especially when it came to African-American men and the responsibility that they had to their children. And it was more of a pull-up-your-pants and takes more personal responsibility kind of a message. What did you think of that?
Oh, I agree with him 300%. Mm-hmm. And I think that I quote him in his very good, strong speech in Beaumont, Texas, where he was calling on parents to get it together and to put their children first and to encourage homework and to be good examples. And I just think that it is very important that all of us, of whatever race and whatever class, take our parenting seriously. And people often ask, you know, what's wrong with our children? I keep saying it's adults that are wrong with our children, and we need to, you know, clean up our act and accept our responsibility and put our children first in our lives. But I also recognize that no parent raises a child alone, and we need community support systems. I mean, parents can't be held responsible for meeting their children's needs if their jobs are gone and shipped abroad, if they're losing health insurance and working two jobs and can't provide that. They need a safety net, and our safety net is at the weakest point ever. But personal responsibility is the first call. Parents are the first line of responsibility, but then we need to reweave the fabric of family and community. When I was growing up in rural South Carolina and segregated, and the outside world told me I wasn't worth anything as a black girl, my parents said it wasn't so, and my church elder said it wasn't so, and my teacher said it wasn't so, and the community felt that they were responsible for all children, and we've lost that sense of community. And I write a letter to neighbors using, you know, a story of the water buffalo herd, which I recommend to people. It's on YouTube. It's called The Battle of Kruger Park. But how it does take a herd or a village or a neighborhood and all of us to support children and to keep them safe. But there are some things that are beyond parents' control. The job loss, which is hitting so many now. I mean, imagine not having a home to go to. Imagine not having good child care that you can afford when you have to work to support your children. Imagine having to walk in neighborhoods where there's violence everywhere and gangs everywhere, which is why we've got to open up these congregational doors and have safe havens from the streets. But parents need supports, and we need to have just public policies. And it's not been right that our country has been taking away from the support needs of working people in the middle class and the poor and giving massive tax cuts to the rich. And it is not right now that we are seeing this enormous investment in bailing out the irresponsible bankers and not helping homeowners and people who are losing their jobs. And so we need to have just public policies, but personal responsibility and community responsibility and the responsibility of the faith community to raise a voice for justice for the vulnerable children all must go into the pot if we're going to have a healthy America.
Let's go to the phones. Bonnie in Madison is with us. Hi, Bonnie. You're on
the
air.
Hi, Dr. Wright Edelman. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I've been a fan of yours since the 1990s, and I'm glad to hear that you're getting on the talk shows again now with the regime change occurring.
Thank you.
I read your article in the Madison Times, and I want to make sure, as I'm making breakfast for the children I homeschool so that I can avoid the Bush No Child Left Behind dictatorship in schools. I had a boy who just would have failed miserably in that. He ended up learning to write about third grade and is now a fifth grader reading Lord of the Rings, but he just would have been absolutely unserved by the schools in such a tight structure focused on testing. In our family, we live on one income, and although the income is low for Dane County in Madison, Wisconsin, we get by, no cell phone, very few frills. And my husband's work has actually wonderful health care for many, many things. And, for example, my third child had a vertebrae displaced at birth, and so his speech was delayed. The phonological approach would not have worked, but the oral motor approach, when we work on the musculature, as stroke victims need done to get the muscles going again, has been very successful. And we have visits for that, which far surpass what my friends whose husbands work at the University of Wisconsin have. We have 20 visits a year. Yet we have co-pays sometimes that are difficult to manage. And we have catastrophic things.
Yeah.
Bonnie, my husband's workplace has good health care in some ways, but not others. And I'm wondering what you can do for those of us who have health coverage, yet the deductibles or the co-pays are steep so that the impact on the employer's bottom line is minimal.
Well, one of the things that we've done in a bill that we drafted and was introduced last year and we're urging again in the kind of health coverage for children now is comprehensive health service that provides all medically necessary services that would incorporate many of the things in that health care should be affordable. There are millions of people who are uninsured, but there are millions more, like you, who may be underinsured. And so the comprehensive benefit package, which is very, I think, mindful of the number of children with special needs, is one that we are proposing. And if we got the comprehensive benefit package in the CHIP program, it would go a long way toward meeting the kinds of needs that you have. We think that all children should have all medically necessary services, and that can be guaranteed in the proposals that we're putting forth. And so I hope you'll look at our website, and I hope you will make it clear to your representatives that we should have all children, but all of them should have guaranteed comprehensive benefits for all medically necessary services.
Bonnie, thank you very much for the call, and good luck to you and your family.
Indeed.
Tom in Green Bay. Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Some of the things that you talk about could be addressed by a program that's in North Carolina that's called the Durham Scholars Program, where the universities do aftercare of kids between 3 and 6 when parents are working. They also act as role models. Some of these kids have some pretty impressive resumes when they go into work. They also get, as they go through high school, they get the ability to get scholarships to college through this program. It takes kids from the inner city and basically says, this is how you've got to dress for success. This is what you've got to do for success. It also works with the mothers. They got social workers that work with the mothers, the single parent mothers, so that they understand what the program's doing. And a lot of the mothers are not educated enough to really understand it, so they work with them with that.
And what, Tom? You think that this is something? This is just in one state, and you think it should be on a national scale or something?
Yes, I think it should be looked at fairly closely because it's I heard the gentleman talk from there on talk radio about 6 months ago, and I was impressed with it.
Yeah. Well, there are wonderful programs like this all over the country. They need to move to scale, and I'm so happy to hear about the Durham ones. We have wonderful summer enrichment and after-school programs in Charlotte, and we have wonderful ones in Raleigh and all over. And one of the things that we must do is the 21st Century Learning Program, which is an after-school program. Funders after-school programs needs to be opened up to a range of community groups so that we can really begin to ensure high-quality, creative programs of the kind that you're describing in Durham and which exist in many places, but there are many, many gaps in these programs, so that we can open it up not just to, through the schools. I think it should be also available to community groups to run these programs, but we have models of what works. We know what works. We know what to do, and we just need to enshrine it now in good policy, focusing on quality and on making sure that every child who needs these services can get them. But thank you for sharing the Durham example.
Yes, thank you very much, Tom. We are talking with Marion Wright Edelman. She is founder and president of the Children's Defense Fund. The Children's Defense Fund celebrating its 35th anniversary, and she has published a new book in conjunction with the anniversary, The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small, Charting a Course for the Next Generation, talking about what that course ought to be for the next generation, what is needed for America's youth, how do we end poverty in this nation and the problems that result from it. 1-800-642-1234. We welcome your questions and views for our guest. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. Kathleen and her guests will discuss the meeting this week between President-elect Obama and former Vice President Al Gore and a look at the future of American environmental policy. That's coming up after 9. Right now, we're talking about our policies when it comes to our children, with the founder and president of the Children's Defense Fund, Marion Wright Edelman. Her latest book is The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small, Charting a Course for the Next Generation. And Marion Wright Edelman, that title comes from an old fisherman's prayer?
It comes from a fisherman's prayer. The Scots and the Irish and the Scandinavians all claim it. President Carter and President Kennedy had it on their desk in the White House, in the Oval Office. And Admiral Rickover used to keep it in his ship. But I found it in Harvard Square one day. But it had this drawing from this young child by a little girl named Maria Cote. She was about 7 at the time. And I loved it because it reflected what I think the Children's Defense Fund is trying to do, is to give children sturdy boats to get to safe harbor into the future. And so it became our trademark. And so the full phrase says, "Dear Lord, be good to me. The sea is so wide and my boat is so small." And at the moment, with all the problems and new challenges, I think, of parenting, and that so many millions of children in our own country, overprivileged as well as underprivileged, I talk about the problems of affluenza and the excessive preoccupation with things and our culture that glorifies violence and sex. We all need to come to grips with our responsibility to the next generation, but it just seemed the right thing at this time, when so many voices and false prophets are vying for our children's values, that we all need to come back, because too many of our children have such leaky boats and they don't have, you know, the anchors of family and faith and of education and health care, which they all need. And so that was the title that suggested itself to me, and I think that we all owe children the tools and the skills and the love they need to make the successful transition to adulthood. And nothing is more important than, I think, passing on a better future and a better generation, a better nation and world to the next generation. And having had grandchildren, and I write a letter in this book to my grandchildren, I've become radicalized all over again by the need for all of us to build a world that's fit and safe and to make sure that our children do better than we did. And that's not going to be true for many, many millions of America's children, because we have, I think, been eating the seed corn, and we're choking them with debt, and we're leaving them a world at the moment that is much more precarious than we inherited, and we must change course. And that is the hope and the responsibility for the next administration and for all of us.
Our next caller is Judy in Waukesha. Hi, Judy, you're on the air.
Hi.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning. And I just wanted to cite some things from the situation I'm in. I had a daughter who just died. She's 38.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I have a 6, 9, and a 9-year-old.
Oh, my.
And she was adopted, so she had all that baggage that she inherited when her mom was on drugs and had her. And that's one problem we have. We have all these mental health issues with these moms. Mm-hmm. And, well, people in general. Our system, the mental health system, is broken. We don't have assistance out there. So these moms who maybe inherit baggage that they had no choice in make bad decisions because of it, because they're not treated. They have to go through this maze of assistance, and it's impossible to find the system to get in there because there's so many caseworkers with so much of a caseload they can't help everyone. And then they try to get out there and they try to work, and their salary's so low they can't afford child care. My daughter had $641 for a month, and her children each got $8 a month. And she was expected to pay all of her expenses of rent and school supplies and, you know, all of the expenses of living, and still be able to have some type of quality of living, and there isn't any. The children are getting more money with her dead than alive.
That's so very sad.
That is very sad, and I'm so, so sorry. And let me just say, kudos to you. I mean, there are 4 million grandmothers, grandparents, who are raising their grandchildren. And at the Children's Defense Fund, we work very hard to see that they can get the supports they need to do the right thing for their children. But I just want to, grandchildren, I just thank you for your concern. But this problem that you describe repeats itself over and over again, and that's one of the reasons I feel so strongly about prenatal care for every pregnant mother. I mean, we are the only industrialized nation that doesn't provide it, but we could identify early substance-abusing mothers and try to begin to get them help before the baby is born, and to try to help them with their problems, and when those babies are born, to try to pair them up with parent assistance programs and support programs. There are many wonderful things that try to programs out there that try to help parents with these special problems of domestic violence or of substance abuse, and give them the supports that they need and often don't get. But we are like an underdeveloped nation in producing low birth weight babies without prenatal care, substance abusing babies, alcoholic children. We know how to prevent this, and this is why I feel so strongly that we should be investing in health care for every child and every pregnant mother right now, so that we can break this cycle and not have children come into the world with 3 or 4 strikes already against them, and not having parents who are struggling to do the best they can, not get the help that they need. Our mental health, we don't have a mental health system, and we really do need to begin to make sure that there is parity, and the Congress has moved toward that, but without access to the actual services, it's not going to work. So we must put into place right now comprehensive health care, mental health care for our children and our pregnant women, so that the kind of tragedy that you say you have experienced, and I'm just so sorry, doesn't repeat itself. We can do better. We know how to do better.
Yeah. What's your view of the safety net today? Is it adequate?
It's at its weakest point in memory. It's at a time of extraordinary growing need. We don't have a safety net beyond food stamps. As you know, the time limits on many welfare payments have already gone out. Our health safety net is got these enormous holes with tens of millions of people without health insurance and millions more who are underinsured. Hunger is growing everywhere, and we must make sure that there's a significant expansion of food stamps and child nutrition programs in this era of economic downturn. It is, you know, people have no place to go. We've gotten used to shelters. And so we have got a job here of rebuilding and reweaving the safety net, particularly now that so many more Americans are going to be facing extraordinary needs. And maybe this is a moment of opportunity, because so many thought that this could never happen to us. And most of the people who are poor are working and playing by the rules. But this is going to be an unprecedented time at a time when there are these huge gaps. And so we must look at how we provide a bottom line safety net of decency for all of our people, and, you know, I think what we're all facing already and are going to be facing over the next year and 15 months calls on us to reexamine our priorities. And I'm confident that with our raising our voices, that the president-elect is going to talk about how we can begin to put into place the kinds of measures that will let people not just go without the most basic necessities of life. And we must take care of our vulnerable first. And I obviously think that's children, but it's all of us. But I think that children are the poorest age group in this country. No other country lets that happen. But our safety net is very, very weak, and we must address that in an economic stimulus package early next year.
Next we go to Peter in Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Morning.
I may have a unique position on this. I committed a felony in my early 20s, and I ended up getting married and ended up getting a very good job and ended up having a couple of kids, and I ended up having a disability that caused me to have to quit work, and I lost everything. My wife left me, and I ended up having my two kids. She left me with the kids, and I was on disability, and I had kids in school. And I found here in the state of Wisconsin that it took me a lot of effort to get the help that was out there, that it was there. But it took some effort on my part to get up and do it. And there were plenty of mornings where my illness caused me where I just didn't feel like going to that meeting, or I didn't feel like going to fill out that paperwork, where I had to get up and I had to do it. And, and I've lived for the last, 7 years now, completely opposite of what I had grown up doing and grown accustomed to. And I hear this lady on the phone talking about how there's this terrible wasteland of people not being helped. And, some people don't take responsibility for their actions. And I've always felt in Wisconsin, there wasn't one need that I needed wasn't taken care of by the system we have in place.
I'm very glad that has happened to you, and I believe in self-help. I believe everybody should take personal responsibility in this. You get up in the morning and do what they're supposed to do for themselves and for their children. There are a lot of people who don't know what benefits and things are available. There's a lot of bureaucracy that has to be mined. 6 of the 9 million uninsured children who are eligible for it don't know about it and are not getting it, and many parents, and I get these stories every day, for every person like you who says that I'm getting what I like and I need, and I'm so pleased. But I know that there are many, many millions who are working their way, trying to get through the bureaucracy and are not able to do it. I've known parents who applied for the Medicaid and the CHIP program in Texas because they knew their children had fatal cancer and kept getting turned down or turned away by the bureaucracy, and their children died. I know parents who tried so hard in Maryland to find a dentist that was affordable and went to 26 dentists and tried to work their way through the system, and they could not get a dentist to take their case. And little DeMonte Driver at 13, after his mother tried everything, ended up having his tooth abscess and his brain then infected by that abscess, and then he was rushed off to Children's Hospital after 26 dentists turned him down and the state didn't help him. Had an operation, but he died. It was too late. Children should not be falling through the cracks, and I'm so pleased that you're getting what you need, but there are many, many gaps, and that's one of the reasons we're trying to make sure that we have automatic enrollment, just taking health care, because that's life-giving, at birth and automatically, so the parents don't have to go through these application processes repeatedly. And I have been very moved with all the parents who call and who've been trying over and over again to get what their children need, and either the gaps are there or they have not been able to weather that bureaucracy. So there are a lot of people who can do better, but a lot of them don't know, and there are many more, I believe, who are trying to do what they can, but the services and the benefits are not there. And, and we should call for personal responsibility, but we should also make sure that our public policies are responsive to those who are working and who may not fit the narrow eligibility, but who do need help. And so it's about balance, and I don't think that we should just make sure that our policies are fair. But I just know that there are many people who need child care, who need mental health, who need health care, people who are working and who cannot pull themselves out of poverty because the wages are not adequate. You know, we've got to look at the whole thing. And so, yes, by all means, get up and do what you got to do.
Yeah.
But when parents are trying to do that, the services need to be there.
I have a final question for you, Marion Wright Edelman. I mean, you've been working on these issues practically all of your life, and it's been 40 years since the Poor People's Campaign. There was a war on poverty. These are issues through the 60s. These are issues that are being struggled with every decade. Is the war on poverty a war that can be won?
Of course, it can be won, and we never really had a war on poverty. That's why Dr. King called for Poor People's Campaign, because we were spending in the months and weeks of his death, we were sending $60 billion to the military, but we were spending $2 billion on what we call the war against poverty. I mean, he knew that was an unequal war. And while we've made very significant progress, we're spending $10 billion a day, we've spent trillions on the Iraq and Afghanistan war. We've not spent trillions on ending hunger in our country again, and on making sure that people have decent jobs at decent wages, and investing in child care. And so it's about balancing our priorities and reordering our policies toward prevention and early intervention. And so we can win it. It's about really making sure that we put our children and those who were most vulnerable first, and invest in work and invest in decent wages and invest in education to break the cycle of hopelessness. We know how to do it. We simply have not done it well enough.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Marion Wright Edelman is the author of The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small, Charting a Course for the Next Generation. She is founder and president of the Children's Defense Fund, celebrating its 35th anniversary this year. We thank her for being with us. We thank you for your calls. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour. Thanks to Rob Ferret and Cynthia Schuster for on-air production and direction. If you'd like a CD copy of this program or any of our talk shows, call the radio store, 1-800-747-7444. We also archive our talk shows on our website, WPR.org. Tomorrow at this time, it's Friday, and that means it's the Week in Review. We will have two guests from different perspectives to talk with you about all the political news of the week tomorrow between 8 and 9. I'm Joy Cardine. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.